Now, in the meeting before last, we started speaking about Weizmann and your relationship with Weizmann. But we only started. So, it was the meeting before last, not the last one. And now, I want to go back to the nature of your relationship with Weizmann. When did it start? And how it developed? And I tell you why. You mentioned that I think that in 1940 or 41, when you decided that you are going to Washington or to New York, you came to consult him too.
Correct.
Now, how come? I mean, that meant that you were already either personally or politically or.
With a friend, yes, I'll tell you. I met Weizmann very late, comparatively speaking. People used to urge me to meet him. For example, there was a girl called Ingrid Warburg, who was a member of that family, daughter of Fritz Warburg, who was quite pretty. Weizmann had a certain interest in pretty women, as you know. And she became a friend. She was a Warburg, she was a Zionist, so on, you see. So she kept saying, would I come to tea with her, to meet him and so on. But that I don't know why I didn't want to meet him quite under those auspices. Maybe I would have done, but I paid no attention. The first time I'd seen him once or twice addressing Jewish meetings. But drawing room meetings, not public meetings. So I knew what he looked like. But that's all I knew. And first time I actually spoke to him was in 1939, I would say. Maybe 38, 39. I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was a member of the committee, whatever it is, the Friends of the Hebrew University. Of course, Bentwich made me there.
Before the war,
yes. Yes, I wasn't. I was 30, I was 29, whatever it was. No, much more. I was rushing for the middle 30s, probably. Bentwich discovered his wife was called Souls. Therefore, I was a Jewish academic. There weren't many Jewish academics in that kind of position, so that he somehow became aware of me and enrolled me, made me a friend of the Hebrew University. And there was a meeting in whose house was it? In Park Lane, it must have been Israel Zeev's house. No, in Simon Marx's house. Which was addressed by Samuel, by Wacob, by various people of that sort, and my duty, I was instructed to second the vote of thanks to Mrs. Lady Marx for, not Lady Marx, no, Lady Zeev.
Yes,
no, Zeev's house, not Marx's. The Lady Zeev, not Marx.
Marx's
sister. Marx's sister, no. No, they're different houses. This is Marx's sister. Want to second the vote of thanks for allowing her drawing room to be used for this purpose. It wasn't a very prominent part of the proceedings. So I tried to get out of it, failed, so I had to get up and do it. And all I wanted to say was that when we think of Mrs. Zeev, simply we think she's very, very rich. That's all we think about. But that I restrained myself from saying, and I uttered a few conventional phrases. And then Bentwich introduced me to Weizmann, who immediately began asking me who I was and what I was doing. And at the end of this, he said, would I come to tea? Because I was a don at Oxford. All this is very unusual. And he was then living in the Dorchester already. Not in Edison, Crescent, or wherever it was. Must be 39, I think. So I went to tea. with him and his wife. I talked to her in Russian. She rather took to me because I talked Russian. And we made friends, more or less. And then I used to go and see him, not once in 2 months, 3 months, until the outbreak of war and after. And then I went to America in 19, July 40. I was going to Moscow. I did not consult him about going to America. I consulted him about going to Moscow, simply because I saw him. Time to time I told him I thought it was quite mad, the idea of going to Moscow, as I thought. You don't know the story of my journey to Moscow, do you? No, that's a long story, which I better tell you separately. And I said, it's ridiculous, the idea of going to Moscow as a prince attaché, the idea of getting bits of British propaganda into Pravda during the Russo-German Pact didn't seem to be a very promising enterprise, or at any time. He said, no, nevertheless, very good to have Jews everywhere. So I went anyhow. Then I didn't see him until I came back, which was in the beginning, I think very early October, 1940. And then I used to go and see him fairly regularly. And during the Blitz, tremendous noise going on in, not in Dorchester, no, in Hyde Park, opposite, which is where the anti-aircraft guns were. And he never, everybody used to rush to the cellar, but he didn't. And I was very frightened, but as he was not, I stayed with him. And then he told me endless stories. If he wanted to charm one, he was able to do it, and I allowed myself to be charmed. He told me endless fascinating stories about people, about his life, about the Zionist movement, about individuals. And I used to go and see him fairly frequent intervals. Then, that was in October, November, December, January, 40, 41. Now let me see.
Then you were asked to go sit for the second time to Washington.
In 41, yes. That is correct, I think. In 40, I already went to him. But that was when I was not in Washington. In 41, no, I didn't go to Brigham. No. In 41, basically, was given a job in New York by the Ministry of Information, and I said goodbye to him. At that time, his son was already killed. Nearly the second son in the Battle of Britain. They were in a terrible state. And he went to Washington, or New York, but the same time as I did. He and his wife traveled to Portugal, because I saw him in New York in 41. When I lived in New York. I was in New York from February 41 till, roughly speaking, I don't know, but February 42 perhaps. March 42. What? Winter 42. Then I went to England, and when I came back I went to Washington. Except that I fell ill. No, that's in 42. I traveled in an airplane in spring 42 with Lippmann, Walter Lippmann and Crossman. And Crossman was tremendously rude to Walter Lippmann. Tremendously. Well, Walter Lippmann was a gentle, quiet, rather crypto-Jewish sort of man who was snobbish, Anglophile. Crossman pitched into him and as you can imagine, was hideously rude to him. Well, I knew them both. I'd met Lippmann just. Crossman knew very well, intimately. I've just talked about him to Anthony Howard.
Yes. He, by the way, if he wants to ask me about his Zionist state.
He can.
I'm telling that he can.
Mm. Well, I know you shan't see him again.
No,
you can write him a postcard.
No,
say it, I met you.
Yes.
And if he wants to ask about that, then send him a postcard to the Observer. He's a deputy editor.
Yes.
You see? So you probably know more about relations. You got a lot of people like that than anybody.
Right, you see. All the people who cook
exactly,
there.
Exactly.
I'm not
you can say,
there.
I met you and I told you, I've been talking about Crossman. If he wants to know about his Israeli stuff, you are the man.
I'm sure that somebody will recommend it anyway. When you will want to find out about the relationship.
No, I think he's probably quite willing to sort of make notes whenever possible. That's all. You'll be in Israel by then. Why don't you do it? You can ring him up, you can do anything.
No
reason why I shouldn't have told you. Well, all right. Then I used to see when I was in New York. I must have seen him frequently. I lived at the St. Regis Hotel. And I lived simply where I saw him at least twice a month, not more often. I can't remember how long he was in New York. When he went back to England then or what happened. He was in a very crushed state. But his son's death.
I'll tell you, I think that most of the time he was in the States.
Yes.
He came back, and then went again.
That's quite correct. I just wonder I'll tell you what I know. I know the following, yet you have the dates. Well, in 1941 I lived in New York. And I was the British Invasion Service. And I was a propagandist. And the reason for my job, one of the things I had to do, was to make propaganda of the Jews. And the Ministry of Information, before they sent me to do this, consulted him, but in London, but whether I would be suitable. He said, totally suitable. So he was one of the people who was consulted about my suitability as a British ambassador to the American Jews. I had other constituencies also. I had to talk to Catholics, Mormons, all the non-Jew, all the unsmart groups. What? Yes, certainly they do. Well, I've told you, I don't know if I ever told you the story, it's quite amusing, about how I learned about the American labor movement.
You told me very long ago, and I don't remember. I tell you when, it was just an opportunity. You met at my house, or at Yoshua Arieli's house, a colleague of Yoshua, who was American, a sociologist, who was then very active in the trade unions. And
I remember the man. I remember the man. So I tell you the story. Let me tell you the story now. Let me tell you out of order. No, you want to go with Weizmann, all right. I'll finish with Weizmann, wait a minute. So I was in New York in 1941. This story happened in 1941, the story I'm about to tell you, naturally. Then came Pearl Harbor, and then I was transferred to the embassy in 1942. That's also the story of why I was transferred. It's a separate chapter, but nothing to do with Weizmann. Then I came back from England in the summer of 1942. Late, early summer 1942, I think. That kind of season, anyway. Maybe middle of summer. With Crossman and Lippmann. And I caught pneumonia on the way. Because the airplane kept on going off and coming back, and I had to sleep in a very cold room in Ireland. This is where it all happened. And there was a man who coughed all night, an architect. Anyway, I came with pneumonia to New York. Then I went to hospital for a month, and at the end of the hospital, I recuperated in Weizmann's house in the Catskill Mountains. He had there was a thing called Grossinger's, the famous kosher establishment with cottages and restaurants and God knows what, rich establishment. The Borscht Belt, it's called. It's called the Borscht Belt. The Borscht Belt in the Catskills, and that's where he had a house. And Mrs. Weizmann describes all this in her autobiography, my visit. And That's where I stayed for about a fortnight. Then I came back to New York and then went straight on to Washington. After about a week in New York, to the embassy. That's where my embassy life started. After that, I saw him much less often, because he was in New York and I was in Washington. When I came to New York, I used occasionally to go and have tea with him. When he came to Washington, he used occasionally to ring me up and I would then go to some rich Jew whose house he was living, or some hotel, and see him. This went on until he went back to England, which was, I don't know when, 43 maybe. I think he probably was in England, 43. And maybe not. Maybe 44.
I think
and 44, certainly. But maybe before or after. Anyway, Joseph Cohen was my go-between. He used to come and see me, in general, to chat. Joseph, I knew he was dead. Very recent. No, less than that.
Even less.
Yes.
Now,
and Weisgall I knew, of course. And Weisgall and Joseph Cohen were the intermediate. The other people he saw most.
Joseph Cohen was also in the States?
What?
Joseph Cohen.
Went entirely. With him. Continuously. He was attached to the secretary. He was his personal secretary. And of course, Bergman, yes. But Bergman was scientific. Because they went together to wherever it was, Middle West, where experiments were made, a place called Terre Haute, where there was a laboratory, where the oil was cracked, and all the rest of it. And I used to go to dinner with Weizmann. Sometimes Israel Seif would appear, sometimes Victor Cazalet would come, and those kind of pro-Zionists, Will Demeter. I went, I remember, to Seder's, which Weizmann, did he hold them himself, or did he go to other people's houses? I think, probably, I was taken by him to, let us say, someone like Kramarski, who was a rich banker from Hamburg, in New York. They probably organized the Seder. I went once there after at least to Zderim with Weizmann in New York. And then Dorothy Thompson would come, and Weisgall would come, and a man called Joe something, was a sculptor, would come, Joe Davidson, was a sculptor, those kind of people. I never knew whom. And of course Weisgall, of course, Mrs. Weisgall, and Joseph Cohen, who was not married, and that sort of person. On one occasion, Der Razaz, who was a really dreadful man, called André Meyer, was a multimillionaire. He gave money to Weizmann from time to time, because Weizmann was useful to him in ways which I'd rather not commit as his instrument. I could tell you that apart from that, he was from the richest Jews in the world. But he got into some trouble because he traded with Spanish firms in 41, which in turn and dealing with them. Morgenthau's agents caught him ready and Weizmann persuaded Morgenthau not to be too hard. And for that he got large sums designed for him. Now, Weizmann. Well, there's not much more to tell. We became terrific friends, became great friends, and then after that, I saw him in London in 45. And when he was in a pretty bad state, he was then negotiating mainly with the head of the colonial office, who was a man, what?
George
Cater, who was not unsympathetic. Then we got on quite well. You see? But he used to tell me about people who, he hated Curzon, of course. More than Curzon.
Yes.
In the early days, when he went to see Curzon in the Foreign Office is hit. Lord Curzon, the temperature of his office has gone down by a very great many degrees since I was here last. Mm-hmm. And then he disliked Lloyd, because he wouldn't create the Jewish army, of course.
That's earlier. That's in the war.
That's in the war.
Now, during the war, he would go and see John Martin.
Yes.
And there was a certain Morton in Churchill.
Morton's head of intelligence,
he was
head of intelligence. Correct.
It was very crucial, the zone, because I'll tell you why. I don't know whether you know. Our agreement, the Jewish Agency agreement with SOE in 1941, that defined our commitments and HMG commitments, enabled us to use the air connection, how do you call it? The telegraphic connection, the secret telegraphic connection of the SOE, we could use it for our political purposes, which means Weizmann could contact Washington or Jerusalem. The only stipulation was that it should be unclear, not coded. And that was of immense importance, because that enabled us to be in Weizmann to be in contact with Zionists all over the world during the war. And it was so in London.
Quite so.
And in 1943 there was a crisis and it stopped. That's another story. Then, and Morton, several times when he would say to his friends that he saw Churchill, he actually saw Martin. And
he more or less kept sat downstairs and tricked the visitors. Very close. I mean, he was the man employed by him as liaison intelligence and general liaison. I mean, he was a man who, passed on. If people wanted to see Churchill, he always had to approve. Unless he knew them, or they were important people. But if there were people from outside, he had to check up on them.
Now, how he became close to Churchill? In the 30s, he used to provide him with information. See?
About the Germans.
About the Germans, yes. And about the Chamberlain's politics. I mean, there was a certain young Ralph Wickram.
Oh, I know who that is. I knew his widow intimately.
She was the wife of Anderson.
That's so.
And they were the young...
Wickram was very anti-German.
That's the point. That's why he was
ready. Of course. Ralph Wickram, he was called Wiggs by his friends. He died comparatively early. During the war. Before the war. Beginning of the war, yes.
He and another young, very bright,
Foreign Office boy. What?
Another with him. I mean, he was killed or died?
Died.
And that's how he became close to Churchill. I mean, Morton. Yes, but coming back to you.
I can tell you still a joke about Morton. Nothing to do with anything we were talking about. Martin told me that he was in the room when Sittert came down the stairs to see Churchill. Of course, they were on very good terms, too. And Churchill turned to Morton and said, John, whatever his name was, our friend...
Desmond,
our friend Van has many wonderful qualities. We all know that. We all love and admire him. But there is one property he has which no other human being known to me has. It's unique in the world. So far as I know, he's the only man who possesses it. He likes Dalton. It's a very Churchill story.
Yeah. Churchill did like
Dalton. Whom? Of course not. Nobody liked Dalton much. Gaitskell, he had proteges like Gaitskell and Crossland. Jenkins.
One can say something, that he encouraged young people.
No doubt. He was somewhat anti-Semitic. Yes, he was. And he was homosexual. All these things are true. All these things are true. Loud voice.
Yes, I
loud, loud, coarse, yes, shouted, so. Shouted.
And if I don't move,
and that's right. Exactly. I remember. You're not a bad man. Just happened to be anti-Semitic. They all were. I mean, not any. Bevin wasn't so terribly anti-Semitic to start with.
No, he was less than many others.
Became so, but Morrison certainly was. Morrison certainly was. In the Labour Party, Hadley, in a quiet way, didn't like Jews.
And he was from the very beginning anti-Semitic.
That I know, but he didn't like Jews.
Yeah.
And what's the name? Roy Jenkins, who wrote his life, told me that.
I won't be surprised.
No, it is so. The kind of Church of England way. I'm trying to think which. The only people who were nice to Jews in the Labour cabinet were. Let me see. Well, Creech Jones later was all right. Who did, for example, the Zionists see? And they were quite close to some protection of the Labour Party.
Pardon?
Who were the Zionists?
In
the Labour Party. No, in the Labour Party.
Ah, in the Labour Party, Berlock.
Now, who is Berlock a C? Who are Berlock's contacts?
He would see many creatures.
Creatures only? During the war?
Not only, but
during the war.
During the war. And during the war, Keith Jones was the private. Parliamentary private secretary of Bevin.
Yes, I see.
That's
now, I'm
why he thought that he knew what Bevin.
Quite. Now, I'm thinking about anybody. Nobody else, after all. There were Labour contacts.
There were Labour contacts. Now,
there must be.
Israel Ziv would be in contact with Bevin.
Bevin was Bevin's leader during the war?
Not in the war.
I'm talking about the war.
During the war, they would see only Christian. I mean, through Keith Jones, they might have seen Bevin.
No, I understand. No, but I mean, say, no other Labour leader.
Never Attlee. As long as Dov Rose lived, he would see Morrison.
Yes, all right.
He had contact with Morrison.
Then the contact we could have.
And now, who else was the minister? I mean, Krebs was, and there was...
During the war, let me see. Nobody. Dalton was. Greenwood, yes.
Greenwood.
And Greenwood's son, yes.
And
Noel Baker. Noel Baker, too, yes.
But they were the weaker.
Of course, yes. And there was, there was, of course, Dalton, but they didn't see him.
They didn't see him. He had some contacts, but I can't remember. He knew Sharet from the LSE days.
But anyway, let's go back to Weizmann.
Yes, exactly.
Then, in 1945, I remember, 45, he was he thought he could do something with Goethe. And Goethe encouraged him. But by the time we came to 46, which is when I came back from Moscow, everything had hardened because of Bevin, government had fallen, and Adolf Bevin, he used to call him Roots, and Bevingrad in Haifa and all that, remember? All that. And then he more or less took up the position, quite straightforwardly, that the Jews would have to revolt. What? Yes. There's no doubt, by that time he was desperate. He said, well, he didn't want it, but if it had to be, it couldn't be let go like that. And I used to say to him, the English want this, the English want that. I think that's what the policy is. I wasn't in the government, but when I decided to have gone by about March, April 46, when I came back from Washington. And he would say, it won't help them. It's too late. It won't help them. We shall get it. In the end, is the Jewish state will have a mandate over England. We shall treat them better than treating us. I might almost say that our enemies say we have a mandate over the United States. It's not matter. Anyway, and then that's when I met Weizmann's Sandman didn't like. And to the dinner with him, when I came to dinner with Weizmann, that I met Weidenfeld, who was the son's friend of Benji, the son. That's how I came to go with him to Israel and so on. I remember very well an episode I have to tell you. Weizmann lived in London. He went to New York in 47, certainly, or during the debate.
Yes.
I mean, the partition of it.
Yes, yes.
Was he in London the whole of 46? He may have gone to Palestine in between.
In 46, he
was... In summer 47, he was in Rehovot.
Yes.
Because I stayed with him.
In summer 46, though. He came to 46 in spring 46 when the Anglo-American Commission was there.
Yes.
That's one thing. Now, later, I believe he had an eye operation in Scotland, or was it in the end of 45? After the war...
Well?
After the war...
Yeah, you're the operation
late
well.
45 or early 46.
Well, the operation.
He had an eye operation in London.
London.
And went to convalesce in Scotland for a while.
With Beverly Dugdale, probably. She had a house.
Yes.
Belfast's niece.
And he was in a very bad medical state.
I understand.
It was, I think, in summer 46.
Could well be. And I'm...
Great negotiations of, I
think. That's right, I saw him in 46, of course, and I can tell you something which happened. Now, what was it? Sorry, I can tell you, yes. I went and had, went to see him before dinner, and he was very contemptuous about my social life. And he said, who are you dining with? Which lord or lady?
I was coming to his attitude to aristocracy and yours.
I mean, there was a lady called Lady Colfax, who was a famous hostess. He said, I call you Lord Colfax. It was a typical... There was no Lord Colfax. There was a man called Sir Arthur Colfax, but he was dead. Anyhow, he used to mock me for seeing all these British aristocrats. And I used to receive it quite well. I didn't mind very much, and he kept pressing me to come to Israel with him and be his sort of work for him and so on, which I evaded. And
he pressed you to join his staff?
He joined his staff. Somehow, you know, then I remember I went to dinner in the Dorchester with a lady called Lady Cunard, who was a famous hostess. He fired London hostess, American by nature. If I had known that she was nice to Ribbentrop before the war, I might not have made friends with her. But of that I only became aware in the last 5 years. Anyway, she was a famous, rather brilliant hostess, and gave dinner parties in the Dorchester by then. Well, I went to dinner, and I sat on my right. I told about the dinner party, because it's a typical, somewhat typical story of the amusing kind. On my right was, Diana Cooper. On her right was a man called Lord Rothermere, who then owned these papers.
The press lord.
The press lord, yes. Son of the other. Then there was Lady Cunard. Opposite was the Peruvian ambassador, Chilean ambassador, Harold Acton, famous East Seat, Clarissa Churchill, as she then was.
Would Clarissa Churchill be
in her circle, certainly. Clarissa Churchill was there, certainly, I remember it particularly. Who else was there? And then the lady, Lady Rothermere on my left, who the famous hostess afterwards called Mrs. Fleming, she became. Anne Fleming, the famous political hostess. But then she was married to Rothermere. And somebody else. And a man whose name I've forgotten, with a name like William Thompson, who wrote a book about Palestine. William Thompson, he was the public relations man for the Ministry of Supply by then. But he was in the army in Palestine. He wrote a very anti-Zionist book, which was widely read and reviewed. And somebody recommended him to Lady Cunard, an interesting man, wrote an interesting book. So this was his debut. He came to dinner and obviously sat next to Lady Rothermere and wanted to impress her, because he obviously wanted a job on some news. Anyhow, he was quite new. I knew most some of the people, but he knew nobody. And this was his sort of debut, it was. All right. And I was talking to my neighbor. Suddenly I heard him say to my neighbor on the left, to Lady Rothermere, though he was flirting, he was very handsome. He said, no, the Zionists are terrible people. They're dreadful. What they do to the Arabs is absolutely ghastly. I mean, they're practically fascists, you know. Not creative. I mean, they're cruel, they're nasty. They've stolen our country. Did a lot of anti-Zionist talk. I listened to this and thought, oh God, do I have to interrupt? Do I stop the dinner party? It's always rather an awful thing to have to do. Embarrassing. Then I had to say, Weizmann, of course, you know, Dr. Weizmann is all right. He's given them up. He no longer sympathizes with them. I mean, he knows, he thinks they're terrible too. He's a perfectly decent man. He can't have any business with them anymore. He's really left it, you know. At that point, I could bear it no longer. So I leant across my neighbor and I said, I'm so sorry, I'm afraid I've inadvertently overheard what you were just saying about Dr. Weizmann. I left him 3/4 hour ago. And I can assure you that what you say is completely false. I've never seen a man more surprised. Never. At the dinner of Lady Cunard, the last person we'd like to meet was a Zionist. Jew, maybe. The Zionist, inconceivable. Even a Jew, pretty unusual. The only Jewish friend she had, I think, was Obelisha, for some reason. And me, that's all. And so then he started back and said, you know Dr. Weizmann? I said, yes. I know him very well. I've just seen him. I can assure you he's 100% in favor of the State of Israel. And of nothing else. It was not at all true. The Weizmann didn't really want the state. And he said, well, I'm not going to take anything back. I think they're pretty awful, the Jews of Palestine. Are you Jewish? Yes. Well, I'm sure you wouldn't approve. You saw what I saw. So then we had an argument. This stopped the conversation. And we began, and I said, you know, the Arabs have rights, the Jews have rights. I think some compromises breach, some statement of that type. And Clarissa loyally said, I quite agree with you. I'm sure that's the right way to go about it. It was before she was married to Eden. And Lady Cunard, who couldn't take less interest in the whole subject, decided it was going to be a great bore. So she said, oh, I've been listening to you talking. We're all on Isaiah's side. Everybody here agrees with him. She said, loud voice. Man, all the same, I can't agree. But he was squashed and talked no more. At the end of dinner, he came up to me and said, you know, we're living in a wonderful country. You have your views, I have my views, we're allowed to express them. Well, where do you live? So I said, well, I live with my parents in Hampstead. Can I give you a lift? I live nearby. He gave me a lift. Quite a nice fellow. Just happened to be a routine anti-Zionist. Because there were many people like that. With some reason. One can't deny it. If you're a British army, in 1946, you could think the Arabs were not being entirely justly treated. Because you and me, this can be admitted.
Of course.
Anyway, I thought I'd tell you this anecdote. Right.
How did you become friends with Lady Cunard? Or...
Oh, because Clarissa took me to dinner there. And during the war, when I came back in 1944, she said this is... I knew who she was. I didn't know such people before the war.
And Clarissa, you knew?
Clarissa, I knew because I met her in 1947, when she was, I should say, wait, She was 18. Then, quite young, and I went to stay weekend with Lord Oxford.
47
or 37? 37. No, 37. I went to stay weekend with Lord Oxford for his mother. Lord Oxford was not a great friend of ours, but at that time,
but
we didn't...
Before you went,
yes, yes, before the war. He wasn't in the colonial office. He was undergraduate at Oxford. He was about 4 years younger than I. He just became a friend. He was very Catholic, very fervent Catholic. We didn't talk about Zionism in those days. I was a friend of his, and he was living with his grandmother, who was called Lady Horner, who was a very famous social lady, a friend of Balfour and Curzon and the Souls, they were called. Yes, she was a central figure of the Souls.
Horner?
Lady Horner, yes. They lived in Somerset, in a house called Mells. And that was Lady Horner. Her daughter was Raymond Escott's wife, widow. And my friend was his son. He was called Julian. And I was invited for the weekend, I went. And there were one or two people I knew. And Clarissa was there. Clarissa was Catholic by birth, because our mother was. And Lord Oxford had to be found Catholic bride. I think that's why she was asked, just in case it was suitable. That's how I met her. Then we became friends. I even met her. I met you. I knew David Cecil, who was at Donald New College in 38. He was a great friend of Clarissa and her family. So she used to come and we used to keep to lunch once or twice. We became great friends. Then she came to Oxford in the winter of 39.
About Oxford you told
me. Right.
Why did she come to Oxford? I mean,
nothing.
To be in the war,
well, because there was blackout in London.
Yes,
okay. There was blackout here too, but not so much. And quite a lot of people. It's a kind of small season.
Yes.
Why not join the lectures? Some sort of self-education. She and Marjorie's daughter.
Okay.
They came together, and people like Fitzroy MacLean used to come here and see them. And
she would come to Churchill during the war for dinners or lunches in Clarissa quite often.
Would come to whom?
To
Winston. Usually the niece.
I mean, yes, but not everybody.
But when?
Like
but when? At what time? When during the war? Because Mrs. Churchill did not like her. Let me tell you about her. She had a nervous breakdown, which lasted about a year and a half.
Yes.
So that I don't think she went out to dinner then. Must have been after she recovered.
I can find out easily. It's in Colville's diary.
Colville's diary.
There are some very important parts, so I had to go through it all. So
he thought it was very attractive. Colville, yes.
But he thought it gay. He was madly in love.
He called it gay, but
Clarissa
went to his memorial service, which is more than I did, although I knew him.
Yes.
He was a friend, I mean, quite a nice man, not terribly clever, but still.
He was pretending to be an intellectual. I mean,
he was not.
I know he was. His diaries are quite interesting.
But of course, what's his name? Chartres used to talk to me about Palestine and Weizmann. Well, he was a policeman there.
Not policeman, he was chief of intelligence.
Chief intelligence, I see.
Chief intelligence, he was a year, which means after he came back.
Wait a bit.
He came back late 46.
What relation did he have to Ballantrae, later to Ferguson? Bernard Ferguson.
But Bernard Ferguson served in the same time, in Palestine.
The same time?
He was brought to Palestine for a few months. And it was not a pleasant job.
Bernard Ferguson left when Farron.
Exactly.
That's when he had to leave.
He was in charge.
Exactly. That's why. But he was never anti-Israel.
No, he was not.
He remained quite friendly.
When he came back from New Zealand, he came to Israel. He was
quite,
nice. I met
quite
him.
Friendly. I knew him quite well. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, Chartres admired Weizmann enormously.
I can tell you about that a lot. Before the archives were opened, He was my mentor.
I understand. He was quite friendly. He was quite nice man.
Because of that.
Not terribly interesting, but perfectly decent. Now he's Professor of Eton, and I still see him.
Do you?
Yes. At dinner party, I meet him.
Yes, I mean, once or twice even talking.
Yes, I meet him from time to time.
I go to see him once a year.
Yes, but I meet him socially. And so on.
Now, he had an open house for Weizmann. When he came to it, because Buffy knew Weizmann, and Buffy was close to, I think she was even related to him.
Could be.
And his mother was very central figure in the souls, I think. His grandmother of Charlie.
The grandmother's famous lady, yes.
She was a friend of Buffy.
Nobody knows what happened, whether it was an affair or not. It's the only possible one. He said yes. That is the general idea. The general idea is it did happen. Nobody could quite establish it. The biographies don't quite say that.
He said that she was a very close friend, possibly the first
time. Yes, nobody is sure. That's what I mean. Nobody is absolutely sure. If there was one, it was she. Nobody else was. That's quite certain. It doesn't matter if shaking. When I shake this, does it make a difference? No. Now, wait a minute, let's go on.
So you said
Weizmann.
You would meet Martin in 47 after he came back.
Martin, I left late.
When he came back, Charles, when he came
oh,
back.
Oh, I left much after it. Long after that. Long after that.
After 48.
Oh, yes.
Ah, that's another story.
Long after that. I didn't know him then. I don't know when I first met him. I think he was probably already the Queen's secretary. Where did we see now? We began with Clarissa. She took me to dinner with Lady Cunard, then took to me. And I used to go to dinner there, I don't know, but once a month, once in 3 weeks. She used to go to these dinner parties, which I met a great many people of a smart kind. But my social life really began in 42. Before the war, the only country houses I've ever been to were the house I've just told you, Mills, which is the house of Lady Keir Horner.
I mean, the mother of Julian Oxford.
Grandmother. Grandmother and mother both lived there. And Watson, where I was in the house for lunch by Jimmy in the spring of 33. Because I'd been made a fellow of All Souls. And for a Jew, to be made a fellow of All Souls caused excitement. Well, of course it was in times, but for a Jew to be made, he knew what All Souls was much grander in those days. You see? And as regard as absolute top, nobody could hire. And he became terribly excited. And couldn't conceive how this could have happened. So John Foster, my friend at All Souls, was instructed to bring me to lunch. So I then went to lunch, and there was Jimmy, and there was Dolly, and there was Victor, and there was Miriam, his sister, and there was Venetia Montague, and there was the Liberal Chief Whip, whose name was, I can't remember, and there was Michael Scatters Wilson, was kind of man about town, and there were footmen lying the chairs, wearing white gloves. And then I made friends with Victor too. Miriam I just met. And Jimmy, I got on with Jimmy extremely well. And after that I used to go and see him frequently in London. From time to time. And in Watson. I've stayed in Watson, which is unusual those days. Because only about 5 rooms were open. The whole of the picture gallery and all the treasures were locked. Double key. Nobody saw them. Everything was absolutely shut. But he used to sit in a huge leather armchair and love gossip. But we got on extremely well, which is the only reason she totally likes me. Anybody who Jimmy likes, she likes automatically.
By the way, she told me that he liked Chef Jimmy, respected them.
Could well be. Of course, But it is possible. Exactly, why not? And certainly, just happened to be an enemy, but he's meant some power, yes, yes. He liked Beaverbrook too. He liked Winston. He was very much friend of Churchill, friend of Beaverbrook, friend of Lord Travel, probably. He was a friend of, there was a thing called the Other Club. It was called The Club, which was founded in the 18th century, to which various people like Joshua Reynolds and Dr. Johnson and would belong. Then there were people who were not elected to The Club, because they were thought to be rather caddish. And they created The Other Club, that was Winston,